Welcome to the Mandatory Social Interaction Show. I'm your host, Eric, along with the Gabby, insert coin, Tim. Tim, how you doing this week?
I'm good, man. How are you doing?
Oh, not too bad, not too bad. So, Ben is on assignment, but he may be joining us later on in the show.
That's exciting. I hope he can make it.
Yeah, I hope so, too. It's a possibility, so we may have to switch gears in the middle of the show just to get Ben's video in the right place, but I think that'll be just fine.
Yeah, that's acceptable.
So, yeah, how's your week been, Tim?
It's been okay. It's been a bit of a roller coaster, but yeah, it's been all right. It's been one of those kind of mad weeks for my content creation. Like, in terms of, like, I mean, I like to reflect weekly on how the week went in terms of, like, viewership and everything. And my community always comes out in force, which I love and I really appreciate. But, like, in terms of, like, new people coming through, it's been very bare bones the last the last week. It's been really weird. It's been a strange kind of thing. Like, Facebook's doing really well, though, believe it or not.
That's cool.
I got like 8 or 9 new followers, and considering I only have like 40 on that platform, that's like, you know, that's like a 20% growth. I can't really complain that much. So
Jank has a good point. There's probably a large contingent of people who are into streaming who are at TwitchCon who are not,
or are watching TwitchCon stuff.
Yeah, you know,
that
there's
sort of stuff. Yeah,
there's
that's
a lot.
Understandable.
Oh, BlizzCon too. I didn't realize they were at the same time. So yeah,
is that this weekend? I thought that was next weekend.
Well, that's what Jank is saying. I don't know if that's correct or not, but you know,
okay,
understandable if other stuff is going on. You know, that would make sense as to why, like, audience participation is maybe a little bit down.
Oh yeah, it is this. Well, no, I think it's November 2nd. I think it's next weekend.
Oh, BlizzCon.
Yes, 2 and 3. Yeah.
Gotcha. Yep.
But yeah, that'll probably be another reason.
Yeah, but TwitchCon's got enough content going on and stuff that I could imagine a lot of people would be over there.
Oh, I'm sure.
So, I mean, I know.
It's funny. I looked over at Co Carnage, who's I'm looking at my followed channels on Twitch. And he's got like 15,000 people watching. So, games like a lot of big games have been coming out too, which always has an impact on interest levels for every other game. So it's I'm not complaining. It's just an interesting. I like to look and see where things are compared to the last week. And I mean, it's always a good comparison point to help my growth without becoming too obsessive with numbers. So it's just interesting because it's like I have this excellent core of people that always come out, which I love, and I appreciate them so greatly. So it's always a fun time. Like, we always have a blast. It's just a matter of, like, getting new people in the door has just been very slow this week. That's
Well, fair enough. And maybe there's, you know, some reasons for that. I mean, some big games just dropped, and TwitchCon and all that, so.
Yeah.
You know. Speaking of games, though, we were talking before the show, and I think there's going to be some interesting discussion here. Because I was thinking we could talk about, actually, you brought this up. Classic games, like what are your favorite kind of classic games, and maybe even where did you start? Because one thing the viewers at home might not know, you know, if you're listening audio only, you may not know this, and if you're watching on video, just my overall childish demeanor might throw you off, but I'm about 10 or so years older than Tim. Mm-hmm. Don't let the gray hair fool you. I would imagine that I have a different gaming history than Tim, yes. And a lot of it's going to overlap, but I'm thinking I probably started a good bit earlier than you did.
Well, it's one of the things I love about gaming, right? Is that everybody's history in gaming is different. How they got into games, how they got started in games. It's such a varied and interesting thing in general. So, before we get into it, though, I think it might be good to... I personally have a differentiation in classic games, right? So classic games are anything older than, like, 2 gens ago to me. So, like...
I mean, 2 gens ago is PlayStation 2.
PlayStation 2, Xbox, OG Xbox, GameCube, or Wii, because the Wii came out towards the end of that, didn't it?
Yeah, probably.
Because the Nintendo never follows a typical generation scheme like everybody else does. They just kind of do their own thing. But anything older than that is classic, and then anything older than two generations before that is retro. But it's all classic, technically. But yeah. I like having that differentiation just because when somebody says, oh, I like retro games, that says to me Super Nintendo, Genesis, you know, that sort of stuff.
And what's funny is retro to me is Nintendo, not Super Nintendo, NES, Atari, and like, you know, you're talking about Pac-Man and, you know, original Donkey Kong, and you know, I mean, the retro to me is you know, what would you call it, like the true arcade games, the ones you couldn't play anywhere but an arcade. You know, to me, so that's interesting that, you know, so you're gonna have to deal with my terminology only from the standpoint that I haven't thought about things in terms of console generations. So you're going to have to maybe help me place them, because I'm not sure. And also I've been a PC gamer for most of my life, certainly my adult life, plus before that, even, you know, when I was a kid, and not that I wasn't also a console gamer, but like I'm not a person that keeps up with every console. So I've never owned an Xbox. The last PlayStation that I've owned was a PS2, which actually I have a PS2 right now, but that's a different story. It's not the same. It's not technically the same unit. I have a Wii U. I've owned a Wii. And I think prior to that was like a PlayStation 2, a PlayStation 1. And before my PlayStation 1, and I bought that when they were cheap, when they were like $99.
Yeah, when they were getting ready to come out with the PS2, when they came out with the PS2.
I think it was a year or two before the PS2, but they'd been out long enough that the price had come down.
Because CD-ROMs, the price of CD-ROMs really tanked. Yeah. And so it was not hard for them to get a drive in there.
But the best part is, I had a PS1, and my console prior to the PS1 was my NES, when the NES was new.
I got you.
So
one of the things that it all becomes a little hazy, but I absolutely love video game history. I try really hard to keep up with generations and stuff like that, but even I have to Google sometimes. There's just a lot of games in general, a lot of game consoles. Like, there were just like hundreds of them that came out in the NES, SNES era that were like crazy, like the Wonder Swan and the I mean, just like you name it, and there were just like like a billion different consoles that are just like so obscure and had like 10 games for them before they tanked. And I tend to only really refer to, when I say like classic games or retro games, is that I'm really only talking about like the more mainstream stuff. Like if whenever I say I like retro games and someone's like, oh, do you have a Wonder Swan? No, that's like not even on the radar, man. Like, come on now. Like, really? Like, it's interesting. It's just an interesting thing. So from my perspective, it's like I try to focus my definitions towards the mainstream consoles and games, just because it makes it a lot easier to discuss and talk about. So,
and I'll be honest with you, I don't actually know what a Wonder Swan is. I'm curious now, but I have no idea about it. I will say this: my very first console. So if we're going to go way back, when I was a young kid, probably about 3-ish, 4-ish, my parents bought an Odyssey 2, which predates the Atari 2600. I think it was made by RCA, and we had that thing for years and years. And, you know, it wouldn't surprise me if my parents still have it, to be honest with you, buried in the attic somewhere. And that thing, the Odyssey 2 was essentially a predecessor / contemporary with the Atari 2600.
That was Magnavox, I think, right?
Oh, it was Magnavox. You're correct. It was Magnavox.
Yep.
And it was, I mean, as a kid, it was, you know, mind-blowing. It was, I mean, as a console now, you look at it and it's terrible. moving big blocks around the screen, essentially. But there were some cool games for it. Basketball was actually, I mean, it bears no resemblance at all to a basketball game now. But basketball was actually fun to play with somebody else. There was Casey Munchkin, which was their Pac-Man clone.
Yep.
There was Pickaxe Pete, which was also kind of fun. And then, what's the other one? Oh, there was a tank game. A 2D, if you've ever played Tron and you know the tanks from Tron, it was very much like that or very similar to that. And that was a ton of fun.
Do you have like an all time favorite like retro game? It can be even PC. Like PC still covers it. It's just in that era, that generation. I'm not talking like if it came out around the time that, you know, the original NES or SNES was around, something like that, that's fine. Like it doesn't really matter to me that much. Just something older than like Battlefield, you know, 1 or whatever.
Oh, easily. Sort of thing. Oh, yeah, easily.
So, yeah.
I will talk. So, and I had an Atari 2600 as well. So favorite Atari game, I would probably have to say is like Zaxxon. Ever play Zaxxon?
I have. It's been a very long time, but a lot of Atari games kind of run together to me because they're very similar.
So it was like
4 pixels. So
it was like a three. It was like a three quarter view. It was like it tried to be 3D with sprites, and so you controlled the spaceship essentially. And you could control up and down and left and right. I'm not even sure what you were attacking, but you were attacking, you know, some kind of base. And that was a ton of fun. I loved that game. In the arcade, my favorites were probably Star Wars, any of the Star Wars vector games.
That one was the one that, what was it, the Star Wars one that kind of still exists today, the vector one. I think that was like really the only one for a long time.
There was Star Wars.
I loved that one.
There was Star Wars. There was a ROM pack for it that you could convert to Empire Strikes Back.
Nice.
And then the Return of the Jedi game is completely unrelated. It's a raster sprite game. So okay. It's not actually a vector game. Return of the Jedi is actually pretty cool, too. Okay. It was rare, or at least it was rare where I lived. I had a hard time finding it.
I love Star Wars, and I love arcade games, and I've never heard of it. So
yeah.
It's cool. I can tell you that it's not common. So
it's cool. The Return of the Jedi one is actually pretty cool. But it's not, unfortunately, it's not a vector game, which vector for Return of the Jedi would have been amazing doing that Death Star run. Would have been a lot of fun. The other arcade games that I really liked were like, I think everyone loved Gauntlet or Gauntlet 2. I don't know if anybody remembers Gauntlet, but that was a blast.
Gauntlet was a lot of fun. I enjoyed the 4-player ones that ended up coming out.
Yeah.
Ones. Yeah.
That was Gauntlet 2. Gauntlet 2 was
Wizard
was
needs
4-player.
Food.
Uh-huh. Oh my God.
Wizard needs food badly.
Yep, that was me a lot.
Wizard is about to die.
And then I loved Elevator Action. This is getting more into the NES, period of time. Elevator Action was a blast. I don't know if anyone remembers that. And then Afterburner 2. Afterburner 2 was so good. That was.
I love the Afterburner games. I actually still play them. Sorry, my Discord is blowing up. I'm getting all sorts of DMs and stuff. So
no worries, man. No worries.
But yeah, it's Gauntlet was fun and Afterburner was fun. I love arcadey flight games. Much like I love arcadey racing sims. That's why I liked the Daytona or Cruisin' USA and stuff like that. I love those games. They're so much fun. and all those like cruising games. And I really, Afterburner's like the main one. It was one of the, I think it was the first like arcade flight sim.
Well, and Afterburner at the time was one of the Sega figured out how to blit sprites onto the screen really fast.
Yeah.
And that was what turned into Afterburner, Outrun, Space Harrier, a few other ones.
Yeah, because they all have a very similar feel, but
they're
definitely different games. But yeah,
I loved Space. I still love Space Harrier. Space Harrier is a blast. It's very much like Afterburner, except you're a dude on a jetpack blasting, you know, weird aliens. They were so fun. And yeah, Chris Wright is saying that the classic Sega arcade cabs were so good, and they were. Does anybody remember Afterburner had an arcade cabinet that you sat in, and if you found the right one, it was motorized. So you actually were in like a motion sim Afterburner cab.
So there was, I can't remember the game, but there was another cab that actually moved as well. I actually played it when I was in Japan. They had one of the arcades had a bunch of classic cabinets, including the sit-down version of the Vector Star Wars arcade game, which
sweet.
I played a bunch. But one of them, it wasn't Outrun, but it was in the same vein. It was like a motorcycle racer or something. I cannot remember, but the whole cabinet would like, if you hit something, it would like vibrate and just stuff like that. And it was so cool because it was like from the early 80s, and it was in perfect shape and it still worked. And it was so cool. It was so cool. Like classic arcade games, just they like, even though a lot of them I never played, like they just fill me with this like sense of like nostalgia and excitement. And it's just like how creative they were with how little they had to work with back then in terms of like graphics capability and processing power is just mind boggling how great it is. So
yeah, I think Chris is right.
Hang On. Yes, that's the one. It was Hang On. Yeah.
Speaking of classic arcade games, Joust was amazing. I love Joust.
Joust was amazing. Yeah. That was a pretty fun game. That wasn't me. I did not ignore that. Anyway, so Joust was a two-player game, right?
Yes. You can play against a computer, but yeah, it's also two-player. And the funny thing about the two-player is you can play co-op, and you can also play non-co-op, because essentially there's PvP damage. So I could joust you just like I can joust any of the other enemies, but if we don't hit each other, you get a bonus at the end of the round for a co-op play.
Okay.
So yeah, it was kind of cool. What was interesting was I played it recently, a few months ago, 6 months ago, maybe. When Garden Sound was in town and visiting Ben, I was hanging out with them, and Garden Sound and I went to, there's a place over here that's like a barcade, called Up Down, we were playing Joust, and I didn't realize there was a co-op bonus, because I think the last time I played Joust with another person I was probably something like 14, and of course we kept running into each other. Garden Sound and I are standing there like playing, and we're very much co-oping, and not like intent, you know. It was funny, we never even discussed it. We just like were like, oh, okay, I got this guy, no, I got that guy, and we were just like instant co-op. And then, you know, the end of the round comes around and they're like, cooperation bonus, and I was like, oh, that's really cool, I never saw that before. So it was kind of, in my opinion, it was almost ahead of its time. It was like, oh, wow, they actually thought about that and put a co-op thing in without really telling you there was a co-op thing unless you found it.
There was a lot of that back then, though, because like what they couldn't explain on the cabinet, they couldn't explain, because oftentimes they wouldn't have instruction screens or anything like that you could look at, especially in the really old arcade games and the like. So it's just pretty interesting.
Yeah, that was super cool. let's see. I'm trying to think of like PC games.
Did you have like an absolute favorite growing up that you just like you can go back to time and time again and it makes you feel like a kid again?
So let's see. I mean, I there were a bunch of games that I enjoyed playing. I played a lot of the Sierra games, which were adventure games. So I've played through the Space Quest series has a special place for me, especially the first three. I don't think I've gotten through any Space Quest game without a guide, because the puzzles were always incredibly obtuse. But they were fun and funny, and I liked Space Quest because it was like it was very much a parody of sci-fi stuff, on par, maybe a little goofier than like Spaceballs. And so I always thought.
Space Quest. Isn't Space Quest by the same people who did the Dragon Quest series?
No.
Okay. I'm thinking the wrong.
No, Space Quest thing. is by Sierra. The first one came out in maybe the mid to late 80s.
Okay. Roger Wilco?
That's the one.
Okay, I was just googling it because I've never heard of it. Then that's really interesting. Okay, so it looks like it's even graphical, or is that the later ones?
Oh no, it was graphical. And actually, it was so the original one was 16 color graphics, which was a big deal at the time. They've released a couple of updates to like the early versions that have added more like added VGA graphics to it and stuff like that. But the original was like 16 colors. And it was it was an adventure game where you moved your guy around, but it didn't even have mouse. It wasn't even a mouse adventure game at that time. So it was, you'd move your guy around with the arrow keys. And then when you got somewhere that you wanted to do a thing, you actually had to type a command, like use mop with bucket.
Like Zork and stuff like that. Yeah.
Basically, yeah. So it was like almost like a graphical Zork. So you could see what was on the screen and stuff, but if you wanted to do stuff, you actually had to type what you wanted. And you could see, I mean, you could get your inventory, you could do all kinds of stuff. So it was very much a hybrid between those text adventure games. As a matter of fact, Sierra's first game was a text game, and then they kind of slowly moved into graphics.
Sierra's a fascinating company. They have a very long and storied history, which they got picked up by Ubisoft, Activision.
I think I think it's Activision.
Yeah, I think Activision bought Sierra. I'm trying to remember because it's like it's been a while since I've really looked into the history of Sierra. But I've been doing like a history of games style show on my podcast.
Oh, absolutely.
Where I've been going through the history of Bungie, and Sierra is one of those ones that I want to do eventually as well. It's just the trick is the amount of research you have to do. And but I've kind of looked into it because I've watched a couple of videos about Sierra and some of their classic games, most specifically the King's Quest, which I think they're the most famous for.
Yep.
But I didn't realize that Space Quest was a thing, so I'm pretty fascinated with that. It's pretty cool.
Vivendi had bought them in 1996.
Activision Blizzard, right? And Activision bought Vivendi Blizzard.
Yeah, Activision. So I guess Sierra as a brand name had gone out about 2004.
Yeah, I know they had gone out a while ago, because I mean their game style just fell out of fashion. It just kind of went away. So it sort of faded into nothing, unfortunately, because they were a great company and they were always a very small company comparatively. They never had, like, if I remember correctly, gigantic development teams like we have today.
Oh, yeah,
like
no.
Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people. It was always like 20 or 30 people, something like that.
One game would have like three or four people. At least the early games,
The early games were, the early games, because they were written by, like, two people, and those same people would work on art or code. And it's like, they were very small teams who made those games. And for how big and expansive some of them are, it's downright impressive, the amount of detail and stuff they crammed into those games.
Yep, and Space Quest 1 was 1986. Which wasn't long after King's Quest. King's Quest, and I had it on the PC Junior. King's Quest was like 1984. Those were like the best games you could get at the time. Because PCs weren't really, and I'm talking about PCs here, so like if you're gonna tell me about your Amiga or your Commodore, that's different. And there's nothing wrong with those things. But in terms of PC games, there wasn't a lot of like arcadey PC games because it was, they didn't really have the power to do it at that time.
Well, there was a big genre split anyways, like for the whole, title of, cause you have your JRPGs, which are your Japanese RPGs, and you have CRPGs, which are computer RPGs, which are Western RPGs. And they were for computer because no console could put out the horsepower to handle all that data at the time, and you couldn't, the input would only work with that, like you couldn't do computer key entries on an NES, you know, so there's a very good reason that they're called computer RPGs, CRPGs, is because that's pretty much where they existed, and almost all of those games were like role-playing games back in the day, like that they had a ton of role-playing games, and they would have strategy games too, which strategy games were rare on console as well, so there were like a lot of the, and I mean, every strategy game was turn-based at the time, but, but ultimately, it was, or they were like 4X strategy games or things like that. So it's just, it's just interesting. It's an interesting history behind, all those various, consoles and the like, because it's been, I don't know. It's a fun thing to look back on and reflect on, because it's part of why I started doing history of games. Because I absolutely adore seeing companies rise up and then just like disappear and like where they went, because a lot of these game companies are like around for like maybe like 5-10 years and they do great things and like explode and then they like get scooped up by a bigger entity and then absorbed and just disappear entirely. And it's interesting because of there's not a lot of sense of lineage in gaming, to be honest. Like for people to say, oh, well, this is a Sierra game. Well, Sierra doesn't exist anymore. Or, you know, that sort of thing. Like most of these, or this is a Criterion game. Criterion doesn't exist anymore. Like a lot of these game companies get scooped up and just, and totally axed by, or absorbed by the game companies or the publishers that purchase them.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's one of the funny things about it is, game companies, other than the really big ones like EA and Ubisoft, don't stick around, and maybe Rockstar at this point.
Blizzard's still around.
Yeah, Sierra was one of the big ones at the time. Yeah. They were huge, and then it was kind of a slow and steady decline as PC games became more capable. Other game companies were able to put out a more console-like experience, and all of a sudden, Sierra's style of adventure game, wasn't as popular because people wanted to play something more arcadey, more console-like, which is fine. I honestly feel like, and this is jumping way ahead, clearly, but I feel like we kind of live in a time where this is like the best it's ever been for any kind of gaming.
I agree.
For console, for PC, you name it, the experience is very, very the same over all the different, I'm playing Arkham. I've been playing the Arkham games lately, and I just got Arkham Knight, and Arkham Knight looks amazing on my PC. And I know when it came out, people were saying it looked amazing on the PS4 and amazing on the Xbox. And it's like, that's fantastic that we can all essentially share that kind of same experience.
Well, and it's only getting better because now with the advent of things like crossplay on the Xbox, where people can play on the PC with their friends on the Xbox, it's like, it's a good time to be a gamer. Yeah. It really is. I mean, yeah, the industry has its problems. I mean, there's problems with like crunch and things like that, which we kind of want to touch on with Ben one of these episodes. But ultimately, it just comes down to like, there's a lot of really good crap going on in gaming in general. Like, I mean, overlooking things like microtransactions and loot boxes and, you know, the gambling bits that are that kind of cast a bit of tarnish on what makes games in general so awesome. It's a lot of fun to see where gaming has come in such a short amount of time, relatively.
Yeah, definitely. So I wanted to jump back a little bit, and I wanted to ask you this question, because I know the answer for me, but I'm curious what the answer is for you. What is the first game you completed? And I'm going to put a caveat on this and say the first game you completed without cheating.
Oh, man. Because I know, tough because
I know the first game I completed, but I had to cheat.
growing up, I played a lot of simulation games, so there was no like clear end.
Oh, okay.
Or victory. I honestly didn't beat games very often. I really didn't. I didn't until I got out of high school, really, because I was very much a... Up until probably high school, I was very much a... I had real bad gamer ADD. I was all over the place. I was just like... I would say... Okay, so I'll say Pokemon. Pokemon Red was the first that I beat. We'll say that much. Because beating is, in my book on Pokemon, is beating the Elite Four. That's beating the main story of the game. So I would say it's Pokemon Red was the
Pokemon
first
Red? Nice.
Yeah. Yep. Because as a kid, I just was all over the place. I, you know, every game I could get my hands on, I'd play and mess with and yeah, you know, goof around with. So it's definitely, it was definitely very hard for me because like things like simulation games like The Sims, SimCity, SimAnt, like any of those Maxis Will Wright games, I was all over. I would just absorb it.
Right. And there's no like definitive end to like The Sims. So yeah, right. that makes sense, sure.
Or the SimCity games or anything like that. There's no you win screen, you know, or congratulations or a Hall of Fame or anything. It's just you go until you get bored with it and you start a new one or whatever. And that's where I kind of like I don't know, it's hard for me to put my finger on it, but I know that Pokemon Red was one of the first games that I completed. That's the one I remember the most, anyways, because I played a lot of Pokemon.
Right, where you essentially played through the entire story and got to the definitive you win screen.
Yeah, well, it's a Hall of Fame, and it's like, congratulations, you beat the Elite Four, Hall of Fame, and you stop Team Rocket from doing their thing, and you know, the whole story kind of has a conclusion to it. And then after that, it's just trading and battling your friends and that sort of stuff. And that's, you know, that's a lot of what I did afterwards is I kept playing it. I mean, I probably put, like, as a kid, I probably put thousands of hours into that game because Pokemon games were my jam as a kid.
Yeah.
Because I'd play the trading card game, and then I'd play the trading card game on Game Boy, and I'd play Red, and I played Yellow, and then I played... And it was just, yeah, I played a lot of Pokemon. I'm a big Pokemon fan, so... How about you? What's the one you remember the most?
Okay, so I did finish. First. I finished a few different games. The first game I know that I finished, but I cheated, was Contra, because
Contra's hard as hell, man.
Contra is a Konami code game, though. So once you put in the Konami code, you get 30 lives. And one of my best memories, and this still involves the Konami code, but it was so great. My mom and I used to play Contra, so we'd set it up, and mom wasn't great. I mean, she was good. She wasn't, like, awful, but she wasn't, like, great at it either. Because, I mean, she was, you know, I was, like, I don't know, 12 or something, and she was, you know, obviously significantly older than I was. So she wasn't maybe as fast and, you know, maybe didn't quite completely understand what, you know, what she needed to do or whatever. And so what was hilarious was... We would play together, and I would put in the code, and then we would play Contra, and we would play it through to the end, and what would happen was she would always run out of lives first, and I don't know if anybody remembers, but in Contra, if you ran out of lives and the other player had lives, you could steal their lives.
Yep.
So then mom would start stealing my lives and I would have to start yelling at her. Not have to, but you know, like, stop stealing my lives. And it was hilarious. it was one of my most favorite gaming memories was like just playing Contra with my mom and having goofy little arguments about, you know, like her stealing my guys and stuff. And we would play it through to the end and it was a blast. If you play it through to the end, that way it's about a 45 minute or 50 minute experience, something like that. You know, especially if you have enough guys, you know, if you've put in the code, so everyone has, you have 30 guys each continue. And then every time you continue, you get 30 more and there's like three continues. So you end up, you know, you can get through the game if you put the code. I can't imagine getting through it without. The first game I completed probably without cheating was probably, I don't know. It might have been Wolfenstein 3D, or Doom. The shareware Doom, you could go through the first chapter, and I know I made it through the first chapter without cheating. Because I sat down one day or a couple of days and was like, I'm going to just go through this one time without, you know, without God mode and, you know, all and infinite guns and all that. And I did. I went all the way to the end of chapter one, which is what you could do shareware, like what you could do without buying the rest.
Right.
And the end of chapter one sucked because you get to the end, you beat the final boss, and then you're teleported into a room that is impossible to beat. Where you're teleported into like a completely dark room that's completely surrounded by mobs, and they just beat the living crap out of you and you die, and that's the end of chapter one. And I was like, that was so not satisfying.
That was pretty typical back then, though. A lot of unsatisfying ends to get you to purchase into it or whatever.
Oh yeah,
they did that a lot. So not surprising in the least bit.
So do you have were you a PS1 gamer at all?
Actually, no, I played a lot of PC games, mainly because, so growing up, I used to have to sneak into my brother's room to play a Sega Genesis. And then eventually he got a computer that could play it. And it was a Windows, when XP, what year did XP come out? 2001. So I think it was an XP machine, maybe even earlier than that. I think it was like one of the first XP machines. And so I would sneak into his room when he was gone and play his PC, and I'd play The Sims and stuff like that. So I played a lot of PC games growing up because I didn't have a game console of my own because it was too expensive outside of my Game Boy. So I play a lot of Game Boy games and stuff. But when it came to my first console that I ever had would be the N64. And I got that when I was in when I started middle school. We had moved to Brandon, so sixth grade, so 2001? Maybe a little later than that? No, 2001, I think.
Yeah.
Kind of thing. Graduated 2007, 2003. So yeah, 2000 or 2001 would be when I started middle school. Yeah, that the N64 was our first, but I had a buddy of mine. It was a friend of my brother's named Brian, who I'm actually friends with still today. It's a Ben Burns.
Because then you'd have to redo the whole thing. But hi, everybody.
hey,
Ben, welcome. How's it going, buddy?
Now
with a special guest. So we're talking about classic games, Ben. We're talking about our first gaming experience and like the first like systems that we really owned. And I was just saying that I have like, I was a PC kid and a Game Boy kid up until like 2001 when I got in 64. And so I played a lot of N64 games, but it was like Zelda, Ocarina of Time, and a couple others. But my buddy Brian, who I'm still friends with today, he started out as friends with my brother Kenny, and but we're still friends today. He actually lent us his modded PS1. So, you know, you could play backups and all that stuff. So So he had like 50 games for it, and he lent it all to us. And oh my god, I played Final Fantasy VIII and Final Fantasy IX and all sorts of crazy PS1 games. And seven. I played a lot of seven. I never finished any of them because I don't have the patience for JRPGs, and I never have. But I got to disc 3 of Final Fantasy VII, which is my crowning achievement from that time.
Nice.
Well, disc 3 is the end of the game.
There's like, 4 discs.
Oh, is there 4? I thought it was
there's
just 3.
Four. Oh, I think there's 4.
Yeah. I never made it through. I never made it past. Oh, there's the first battle.
Oh,
you
3. You're right. So I did get to the third disc.
Yeah. Once you get to the third disc, it's basically just the world and the last boss, if I remember correctly.
I got pretty close then, but I was a stupid kid, so I don't know.
Stupid kids. Yeah.
Stupid kids.
I think the farthest I ever made it was there's that puzzle where you. There's a puzzle in that game where you like after you beat Sephiroth the first time or after he flies off or whatever the thing is, like that first confrontation, you're like going around and like there's like a fetch quest puzzle where you have to figure out you have to get this thing to bring to that guy where he gives you this thing to bring to that guy where he get like you have to like figure out where the chain starts and then bounce stuff around. And I think that's about where I gave up, which I want to say is disc 2-ish. And I played Final Fantasy VII on PC.
Well, I may be speaking blasphemy, but I enjoyed 8 and 9 more than I enjoyed 7.
I don't know. I never played 8 or 9.
And honestly, 7 was the only Final Fantasy I ever really played. And it was cool, and I did enjoy it.
It's not bad. It's not... It's a great game, and all the Final Fantasies are great, but I personally enjoyed 8 and 9 better.
So speaking of PS1 games, though, I want to talk about my favorite PS1 game, and that is Spyro the Dragon.
Hey, that's coming out again soon.
Spyro Trilogy Reignited, I think, is coming out in the next like week or something. Yeah, it's coming out soon.
Spyro was so much fun. That was the
first. I don't know if it's coming out on PC, but
Probably not. Spyro's always been an exclusive. Well, it used to be exclusive. I think I read somewhere that's coming. It's out on a multiple. They have games on more platforms than just PS1, but I know PlayStation. I know they originally were I think they were an exclusive for PlayStation. Ooh. For a while. Spyro the Dragon.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, they were on PS1, and they came out with a bunch of Game Boy Advance games after a while.
Yeah, exactly. So it wouldn't surprise me if the new one is multi-platform. That would be ideal. I would like that a lot. That might actually convince me to buy a modern platform.
I think it's actually coming out on. I want to say it's coming out on Switch as well, or there's a rumor that it's going to come out on Switch.
Oh, that would be great.
Let me double check that. So Ben, tell us about your first console and what
my first console.
Yeah, like the first time that you remember really like having your own gaming system that you could really like sink your teeth into. And
well, let's see. My first console, if you want to get technical, would be Commodore 64, which is where I did play games, but I also learned how to program in BASIC, and that was a long time ago. But otherwise, my first console was a Nintendo. Like the original NES. I got that for Christmas a long, long time ago.
Nice.
Back when I was a kid. And I think I just had like Mario and Tetris. And I played a lot of both of those. Eventually, I think I got Metroid either for my birthday or Christmas the following year. And I definitely played a lot of Metroid as well. But yeah, no, my original console was a Nintendo. I think I still have it in the basement. Still works. It's a trip to plug that into like the projector and have it like out on like a 100-inch screen in the basement or whatever. but yeah, no, I played a lot of Nintendo when I was a kid.
Yeah, one thing I wanted to mention about the Nintendo that I think a lot of people don't, I think people of a certain age would recognize this, but people who are a little younger than me might not. And that is the Nintendo was the first time you could play a game at home that basically matched the arcade experience.
Mm-hmm.
And that was insane. Like as a kid, you would, because you would go to the arcade, right? Like, for me, it was like Sundays. My parents were in a bowling league. And obviously, when you're 10 or whatever, they're not, you know, you're not bowling with them. So, right, they would give me a couple of bucks. I would go over to the arcade in the bowling alley and, you know, hang out and play games and whatever while they were bowling, and which was fun. And you would do that, and then you would come home, and like the next day you would play your Atari or like the Odyssey or, you know, one of those things. And it was like even the clones, even Pac-Man or Casey Munchkin or whatever, were not, you know, even the things that were supposed to be the arcade game were these like, you know, kind of horribly condensed, you know, poor versions of those, you know, of those games. And then the Nintendo comes out and it's like, wait a minute, this is the exact game I'm playing in the arcade. I play Elevator Action on the Nintendo and it is the same game in the arcade. I play Super Mario Brothers and it is exactly the same. Mm-hmm. And that was a huge thing. I mean, that was one of the reasons the NES took off, in my opinion. Granted, I was 10 at the time or whatever. So, like, who knows? Maybe that's not the real reason, but, you know, in my young mind, it was like, yeah, no wonder people want this thing, because it's like playing an actual arcade game versus these kind of really crappy versions of them.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you just had more controls and buttons as well. Like, the Atari had the joystick and one button. And,
yep.
There's a very strict limitation on what you can do with those kind of inputs, so...
Well, for me, like I thought the as much respect as I have for the NES, like it was still extremely limited in a lot of ways.
Oh, yeah. Oh sure.
The SNES, it took it to a different level. Like, oh, yeah. If you look at like some of the RPGs that came out on the SNES, like it is, look at Chrono Trigger, Probably one of the most intense, exciting and beautiful experiences in terms of JRPG I've ever had. And I like I've said before, I'm not a big JRPG fan, but Chrono Trigger is like way up there in my book. And the SNES rendered it beautifully, ran it perfectly smoothly. I don't even have words. It's just like the SNES was such a beautiful, and the Genesis wasn't bad either. Like they had games like Shining Force and stuff that were amazing. So I'm not knocking either. I think they were both, that generation of console was like a turning point, a tipping point of moving it away from a child's plaything into more of something that everyone can enjoy.
Oh, absolutely.
Kids or adults. Because games like Chrono Trigger wasn't like just for kids, you know? Like it was had some really super dark undertones and confusing time travel plot and all sorts of craziness. So, it's on another level, man. It really is.
And I was going to say, if anybody's, you know, wondering what a change it was to go to the SNES. Just don't look no further than Star Fox. And Star Fox like looks really dated now because, you know, as 3D graphics go, we're so far ahead of it. But at the time, to have a console at home that was actually rendering a 3D game was huge.
That was massive.
There's a reason that Star Fox got so big and popular. Because it was like mind blowing how good that was. Nice, Tim.
Yeah. And I mean, if you wanted a good comparison of the Nintendo versus the Super Nintendo, just look at the two Metroid games. Like Super Metroid is an incredible difference in quality, music, gameplay, atmosphere, everything is, and I still consider Super Metroid to be one of the perfect games. And I know there's some contentions around that, but I think that really Super Metroid, I know. There you go. Listen, if I had my webcam up, I'd show you the 3DS cartridge I have on my desk that has Chrono Trigger.
Nice.
Super Metroid is just an incredible feat of artistry.
Absolutely.
From every standpoint. And the Nintendo version is good, but it kind of sucks.
Oh, nice.
Sorry, Star Fox. That's fine.
I'm showing off my Japanese cartridges. Sorry.
I love the Nintendo version, but it really sucks compared to the Super Nintendo version.
Absolutely. Metroid continues to break ground, though. I mean, look at the Metroid Prime series. That's a great series of games. And I mean, that was
GameCube.
That's one of the ones. That's one of the ones I want to play on stream one of these days. Is the Metroid Prime series, because it's revered and there's a good reason for it.
Yeah, and you know what's funny? I never had an SNES, but I had a friend that did, because I could never convince my parents to buy one. And you know, when you have an NES and they come out with the Super Nintendo, your parents go, you know, like, no, you have a game console. We don't need to buy another game console.
But mom, exclusives. Yeah,
well, exclusives weren't, and at that time there was no competition. Right. I mean, it was Sega, but nobody was, no kids were talking about exclusives, even though exclusives existed, but basically every game was an exclusive.
Yeah.
I mean, basically, if you had a Sega, you could play this set of games. If you had a Nintendo of any stripe, whatever, you know, you could play this set of games, and then there was no really crossover between them.
Yeah.
When they started doing that was like PS1 and Xbox One, PS1 and Xbox, OG Xbox.
PS2 era. But they did the PS1 and N64 had some crossover.
Did they?
Okay. Yeah, they did. They had some releases that would come out on both. And I think a lot of that started because of games that were coming out on PC were also coming out on PS1. And people were like, why isn't out on the N64? And there was demand for it. So there was a lot of that. There was a lot of that back then where people were just trying to get clamoring to get their hands on whatever games they could.
Yeah.
Because it had taken off. So yeah, it's interesting. There's a lot of really fascinating history behind all of that, including historic prices for games and such too. It's funny that we complain about game prices when they were actually way more expensive back in the day.
Yeah, they were still $60 back then. So
yeah,
but for if you adjust for inflation, they were like $110 back then.
Exactly.
So it's That's crazy how cheap games are compared to back then. I mean, they may seem expensive, but they aren't comparatively. That's why you see games that have the Super Deluxe Edition for $120
and microtransactions and all that.
Right, but they've got to make their money somehow because they're sinking $300 million into these games. So I don't know. I'm just, you know, they got to make profit somehow, and
Well, you got
to
pay.
An argument to have, but
I don't think anybody could successfully argue that the people who make these games should not be getting paid.
Right.
So you know, as much as people want to, and I don't want to get on to this topic too much, but as much as people want to get upset about microtransactions and DLC and loot boxes, you know, at the end of the day, these companies exist to make money, and these people need to, you know, these people need to be able to live and make money just like we do, right? I mean, we all have jobs, and this is that, you know, the. What we're paying for is those people to have jobs making the things we want. So, you know, you can argue with how that should be best done. You know, certainly, like, there's a discussion to be had there. But at the end of the day, these people still need to be able to put food on their table and live, right?
And
just like
honestly,
anybody else.
I feel that microtransactions, loot boxes, and all that stuff is perfectly fine as long as it's done in a humane and non-predatory way.
Yeah.
Yes.
If it doesn't affect the game in a significant way, like in Overwatch where it's just skins, they seem to be doing just fine with that.
Yeah.
It's like loot boxes and microtransactions, all of that stuff is perfectly fine as long as it's done in a way that doesn't exploit people.
Yep.
And
I agree 100%.
I think that's really all it is. And if people want to complain about, you know, people having different skins and whatnot in their game, like, who cares? I mean... Everybody
well,
should
that's
just
part
be
of
a
why...
gray cube that shoots gray cubes, and then, yeah, just show
back in my day,
box.
That was called the Atari.
Yeah, exactly.
Hey Ben, what's the? I asked Tim this, and we kind of both. What's the first game you completed?
Without cheating,
probably
without
Super Mario Brothers,
like with and without cheating.
Super Mario Brothers, probably. I mean, I know that there were games on the Commodore 64 and stuff that I played, but honestly, I don't really know if those games had end states. They were more like high score games. Super Mario Brothers definitely had a distinct ending, which I guess I would say that that's the first game that I've beaten.
It had a credit roll, right? When you finished it? Yeah. And that's my definition for beating a game.
I believe
the credits roll, you're done.
Yeah.
More or less.
As far as like with cheating, probably Battletoads. I got really far in that game. I got very, very far in that game.
I don't think I ever
beat it without actually cheating. I think I got to the last level without cheating, but I just could not get to the end.
I tried to play that online with my buddy George, and we ended up killing each other more often than anything. Yep.
Oh, that's hilarious.
F that game, man. F that game so hard. And this was like 3 years ago, so F that game still. Okay? That game is awful. That game was designed to ruin friendships, is what that was.
So here, one of my favorite games, and it took me a minute because my original thought of the first game that I completed was this, but it's actually not. When I thought about it, it was like, no, I've actually completed stuff before this. But one of my favorites on PC was Max Payne.
Mm-hmm. That's a good one.
Max Payne was amazing.
Good series.
And I went for a while where I played it basically once a year. And the last time I tried to play it, I have it on Steam, and it at least at the time, I haven't tried launching it recently, but it did not want to run on a modern PC at all. It just crashes and burns. But Max Payne was one of the few shooter type games. I mean, I realize it's third person, but it's still I consider it a shooter. It was one of the few shooters that I actually got all the way through, and really, really loved. Really loved it. Played it. I've played that game so many times.
Yep, it's a good one. I played it a lot too.
Can't say I've played all the way through it.
Really?
But it's on my list. Yeah, it's because it was. When did that come out? I think that came out when it was. I was too not allowed to play.
2 years old. Kind of game.
Max Payne?
Yep.
It was like 99-ish.
Yeah, it was late 90s, early 2000s.
Yeah. Well, that's the movie. 2008. No.
2001. 2001. Sorry.
Yeah, so that was before I was allowed to play in games, really. So
yeah. And I mean, I could see that if you didn't start with the first one, as in like you know I was you know it came out and I bought it when it was when it was new and it was mind blowing when it was new. You know, how, like the graphics were amazing. The gameplay was fantastic. And now playing it now as a gamer going back, you're going to look at it and say, wow,
think it's aged well.
The graphics
the
graphics are really dated. You can see all the, you can see where the polys are. There are some bad textures.
A big part of what I do on my stream is I go in understanding that and I still find enjoyment in the games. Like I'll make fun of it. But like for me, a trip down into the ancient history of gaming comes with the caveat, it doesn't age well, but that's kind of why we're playing it, to see how it aged compared to where it is now versus its contemporaries of the time. Because a game like Red Faction, where you could like landscape the whole ground and like make holes and go hide in them and like dig into rooms that you're not supposed to get into yet and things like that, was crazy at the time. And now it's just kind of like been done.
One of the big problems with games not aging well, especially older ones, is control schemes were not standardized, or at least more standardized than they are now. Yes.
It's so bad to play old shooters because, like, especially on PC, it's like, use WASD to move, but if you hit E, it doesn't activate anything. It fires a rocket or throws a grenade. It's like, what? Who designed this? G for grenade. G!
Absolutely. Well, and then if you go back far enough and you start playing something like Doom, where you didn't need mouse control because you weren't looking up and down, you were only looking left and right. The original control scheme, because I remember playing this, and it took me a while. I had to start playing FPSs against other people to switch to WASD. And a mouse, because the original control scheme was arrow keys moved you around, Control and Shift, one of those was shoot, one was crouch, and then Spacebar was jump. And so you would two-hand it, and one hand was on the arrow keys, so that was your right hand, and then your left hand being, you know, like your pinky is like going back and forth between Control and Shift, and your index finger to space, and it's a bizarre. And what's funny is now I don't think I could do it now, but I did that for years.
The control scheme for Descent was even worse. I had kind of a custom control scheme for Descent. So you know how the arrow keys, sometimes you have, in some keyboards, you have like the insert, delete, page up, home, all that stuff above it. So with Descent, you not only have like the pitch and yaw and roll, but you also have strafes and like move up and down.
Yep.
So the lower arrow keys were all the pitching and tilting, and the upper home, end, delete, and page down were my actual sliding left and right and up and down. And then on the left side, you had like rolling with Q and E, and then like the WASD was like other controls. So you basically had to use both hands to control this ship in six dimensions.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people used a joystick, but I actually really liked using the keyboard for that game.
Well, and even with a joystick, it was tough because the way it was laid out so bizarrely. And then Descent was really interesting. Because Descent has, everything takes place in these tunnels.
Yeah.
So it's super claustrophobic. At least it was for me. I played Descent for a while.
Yeah, well,
but it never
intentionally
really
claustrophobic.
Yeah, I know. I didn't like it that much. I played it a bit, but I didn't play a lot of it.
And there was actually a new version of Descent by part of the team that came out recently called Overload, I think. I would highly recommend checking that out if you wanted a more modern take on the Descent series. Overload. It came out probably a couple months ago. But it's very, very good. I didn't get super far in it because now I got a little motion sick when I played it because I'm old and it's a first person shooter. But yeah.
You're overdone. All right, I think my time has come to an end because Recky is now literally in here chewing on my equipment.
Yeah, like we can hear it.
I was wondering what's going on.
Stop! You're moving things around. Shut it out.
No worries.
Stop.
Sorry, I came in late.
Oh, that's okay, Ben.
No, we're fine, man.
Yeah,
it's
we're glad you were able to make it. So. All right, well, I think that's going to wrap it up. I think we've reached our social interaction quota for the week. That was a great show, guys. I really enjoyed that.
It was. It was a lot of fun. Thank you very much. I appreciate it, guys.
So, insert coin Tim, where can people find you on the interwebs?
You can find me on Mixer, Twitch, Facebook, and Instagram at Insert Coin Theater, on Twitter at Insert Coin Tim, and on Discord at discord.gg/ICT.
Ben Burns, how about you?
You can find me online at Twitch, Twitter, Patreon, and YouTube at Ben_Burns, that's U-R-N-E-S.
All right, you can find me on Twitter at ZaxxusEMK, twitch.tv/ZaxxusEMK, and youtube.com/EricKleinCreate. The show is available on Stitcher, Google Play, iTunes, and wherever fine podcasts are sold. Our website is mandatorysocial.com. Our streaming overlay was created by Maris Mintrovert Alicki. You can find more of their work at marisalicki.bandcamp.com. Theme song was Protofunk by Kevin McLeod at incompetech.com, and the background music is by Ben Burns. That's at abstractionmusic.com. Thanks a lot for hanging out, everybody.
Yep, thank you very much, guys.
Yeah, take care, everybody.
Everyone have a good week.